Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Greg Stock. Greg is author of Redesigning Humans, Our Inevitable Genetic Future, of MetaMan, which is an exploration of the convergence of humans and machines, and he's the editor of Engineering the Human Germline. He also serves as director of the UCLA Program on Medicine, Technology, and Society. Welcome, Greg.
Well, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Now, you're getting a lot of really good press for this book, and it's come out at a very auspicious time because the biopolitics of our country has been taken over by a small cult around Leon Cass, and one of his right-hand men, Francis Fukuyama, has come out with a book also about these issues from the diametrically opposed perspective. I guess you're tag-teaming it around the country, is that right?
I think Francis Fukuyama and I agree about the immensity of what is occurring and the possibilities for essentially intervening and reworking human biology. His approach is that this is very, very dangerous stuff, and so we should erect a new regulatory structure that would look not just at issues of safety and efficacy, but to really try and reflect on sort of ethical, social, religious issues and make decisions based on that. And I think that this is just a very wrong-headed approach to new technologies that we don't really even quite understand the details of where they're going to, of the kinds of things they'll offer us.
It's a very important time right now. A lot of issues are being hammered out. A lot of alliances are being hammered out around the competing bits of legislation to regulate embryonic stem cell research. Now, your book is mostly about germinal choice technology, but how do you see that playing? How is that connected to our current stem cell debate?
Well, the cloning has become kind of a symbol that represents all of the rather disturbing or challenging possibilities of intervening in adjustments, modification, changes to our own biology. And it's funny because cloning, you get so many people that will say, oh, well, I absolutely wouldn't want to see reproductive cloning, but we want to do stem cell research, certainly. And you know, the reality is that cloning is certainly going to arrive within 5 to 10 years. I doubt if it's going to arrive in a year or so. It's very dangerous right now, but it eventually won't be. And when it arrives, it's simply not going to be that big a deal. It's the creation of a delayed identical twin, which, you know, admittedly is a little strange, but it's hardly going to shake the foundation of our society. And so I think that it's really a shame that so many people who know better are willing to nonetheless sort of at least publicly act very, very shocked about the notion of cloning and think that that is going to make the opponents of some sort of a dynamic view of who we are back away. I mean, it's very clear when Leon Cass looks at this technology, he sees trying to draw a line in the sand that this is, if we can stop cloning, then we can stop all these other technologies. Of course, he's dreaming, but nonetheless, that's kind of the way things are going. You need to step back and look at the larger picture. Essentially, this is a fundamental breakthrough in the history of life. We are unraveling, we're deciphering human biology, and of course we're going to go in and begin to alter it, because we have all sorts of possible ways that it's going to serve us. And you just have to look at something as simple as anti-aging. I mean, the idea that you could go in and understand the biology that's involved in aging, and it's clearly something that's shaped by genetics, and retard that process. There have even been mainstream researchers that have talked about reversing key aspects of aging. Well, there's a whole conservative wing that thinks this would be an awful development, that this is something we have to stop because it would assault our society. And it's true that if you were to significantly extend the health span of people, I don't mean their decrepitude, but they extend their youthfulness in some way, that it would change virtually everything about the way we live. But this is something that we, I mean, look at what we do with cosmetic surgery and vitamins and how much we'll pay to extend, you know, our period of torture before we die for just a few months. And so it's clearly this is what our aspirations are, and if something like that comes to be, there's no way it's going to be stopped, and it shouldn't be stopped.
One of the most pernicious things to me about Leon Kass and that whole cabal is their appeal and their attempt to validate the appeal to the yuck factor, to moral, alleged moral intuitions. And it just seems like that's the most debased form of moral reasoning, because basically people have yuck feelings about all kinds of things that we don't think are, on the basis of intellectual reasoning, have any problem with them.
Yeah, that's a very difficult justification, because there are all sorts of things that it would cause that would never have been accepted with that. Interracial marriage is probably a good example of that. Although Leon Kass is at least quite consistent, and he still opposes in vitro fertilization. And, you know, so I talked a little bit about anti-aging medicine, that type of realm. Another thing that I really talk about a great deal in the book and explore what it will actually feel like, what the possibilities will really be, and that's in changes to reproduction, in our ability to make conscious choices about the genetic constitutions of our children, including both therapy, the prevention of various genetic diseases, which will be an obvious something that virtually everybody will want, and enhancement, an extension of human capacities or improvements in health, longevity, making people a little bit smarter, a little more talented, live a little longer, all these sorts of things. And, you know, I think the reality is that this is what people would want, or at least they would want to give those advantages to their children.
This is Change Surfer Radio, and we're speaking with Greg Stock. He's the author of Redesigning Humans, Our Inevitable Genetic Future. A lot of the complaints, as you said, come out of a kind of a position of faith, either religious faith or some kind of untestable, unprovable assertions. One of those assertions is that there are limits to what human beings should do, that going beyond these limits will result in disaster. That may be the secular version of it, and be hubris or playing God, which is the religious version of it. How, in a liberal democratic society, do we adjudicate between people who believe that there is hubris and people who don't see that hubris line?
Well, we have, in a society such as ours, where there are all different ideologies and attitudes about these sorts of things, I think we've already, you know, found that the only way that we can handle this without really tearing ourselves apart is to sort of look at, if something doesn't affect other people adversely, if it's not, somebody's not trying to make a nuclear weapon that's going to kill all sorts of innocent bystanders, then, you know, we kind of allow them to do the things that they think serve or are beneficial to them. And I think in reproductive biology, it's going to be our sensitivities will get stepped on, and that means everybody's sensitivities will, because people have very different attitudes about what's important to them and what isn't important to them. But the one thing that unifies all this is that basically you don't have to participate. And if someone is making a choice about whether they want to have a boy or a girl, or making a decision about that they want to genetically test an embryo so that they can be sure that they're not going to have adult onset Alzheimer's in their child, or if they're trying to simply have a child that's a little brighter. Well, you know, these things are not going to damage our society as a whole or other people. At least they won't, the individual decisions won't. And I think that ultimately the choice that we're facing is whether a political group is going to get together and sort of decide what behavior is in alignment with their values, and then force that upon the population as a whole. And even though they do that in a very thoughtful way, and they are attempting to do what's right for the world, I think that that is very pernicious. And the other approach is to sort of say, well, here are the kinds of things that are possible, and there are a few things that are too dangerous, and we certainly don't want to do them, or that they are everybody would agree that they're wrong. And outside of those boundaries, let people make decisions for themselves, and then if real problems arise, we can try and figure out how to address them and how to ameliorate them.
I think that's an important point, because a lot of the people who mobilize their arguments against genetic engineering or genetic enhancement, they are motivated partly by concerns about fascism, about the eugenics of the 1930s, about some kind of totalitarian applications. And one of the things I often say to them is, A, this is what we're talking about is people having a right to control their own bodies and parents having a right to have the kind of children that they want, not some state telling them what to do. And B, if liberal democratic societies don't get on this bandwagon, totalitarian societies will advance faster than we will.
Precisely. I mean, if you try and really ban technologies that are inevitable, and I discuss in a variety of ways why this is the case. I mean, essentially it boils down to technologies that we don't have to seek out. They're simply a natural spin-off of mainstream medical research that everybody wants to see happen. That they're going to get easier and easier technically, and they'll be feasible in thousands of laboratories all over the world. And there are large numbers of people, a significant minority in virtually every culture, and a substantial majority in many cultures as well, that see these as beneficial. And when you have a technology like that, there's no way that it can be stopped. So if, in fact, you try and put out bans and criminalize these sorts of the technology generally, then the effect is that it moves its development underground, so you don't get any information about problems that are developing with it. It puts it into the hands of other cultures and people that you probably view as less responsible than yourself. And it reserves it for the wealthy, because they will always get around these kinds of bans. They're in a position to extract the benefits from these sorts of technologies. And that's just the direction that we don't want to go with things that are going to be so fundamental to the human future.
Let's talk for a second about that unequal access, because this was something that I looked for carefully in your book, and I didn't see you come down very clearly on what the policy prescriptions. Of course, your book is not principally about policy prescriptions. It's more about elucidating and dissecting the different moral issues and trying to knock down a lot of the straw men that are put out. But one thing that you say very clearly is that insurance will be made impossible by a future of accurate genetic diagnosis and prediction. And that as a consequence, we might need to have other alternatives for providing for healthcare. And you also say that unequal access to these technologies will be one of the chief political issues of the future. So therefore, wouldn't that lead naturally to a recommendation that we adopt a national health insurance system and include these technologies as a part of the birthright of every human being?
I think that there will be enormous pressures in that direction. The comment about insurance is that basically insurance is a mechanism to share unknown risks among the population, through the population. And if you know risks, then suddenly it doesn't work. Either people who know their own risks and the insurance companies don't are going to stock up on that and buy a very special insurance that turns out to be expensive, and that's particularly the case with life insurance. And if the insurance companies know, then they will price anybody they won't give policies to people who are at high risk, so it simply doesn't work. Now, we generally feel within a society, a society such as ours, that we want there to be some sort of safety net. We want to cover people in some way. Now, the decision will be at what level, how much medical care can we really provide as a society? And that's going to depend a lot about how these technologies develop. And I think one of the things is that we can really push the development of these technologies in directions that would lead to procedures that are likely to be cheap enough and available on a wide basis. Because, you know, if you have technology of this sort that's only available to the wealthy and the affluent, then pretty soon you have situations where genetic diseases, for instance, which will be relatively easy to avoid by screening, become something that is a concern only of the lower classes. which is a real problem, because then you won't have the same push to develop treatments for them. But nonetheless, this idea of the division between rich and poor is one that is, I think, small compared to the larger divisions that will be created in society and that will be very challenging. And those are between one generation and the next generation and the next generation, because the most advanced technologies that are available to the wealthy today or at any one point in time will be, just primitive compared to what's available to the next generation 25 years later, because these things are going to move very, very rapidly, just as other technologies have, like computers or television sets or anything like that.
I really liked a point you made towards the end of your book where you said that the educated upper class, especially in a meritocratic society like ours, a relatively meritocratic society, have the most to lose from universal access to these technologies, because our kids will have to compete against equally bright, equally healthy kids from the working classes. And that you point out that this may be one kind of subconscious motivation for upper-class Luddism.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. You know, I hadn't thought of that when I started the book, but it became very clear to me that if you have a genetic bazaar where people can essentially go out and purchase various enhancements and such, and that two things occur. Number one is that the technology involved for any particular trait to move it to elite levels, and they can take some talent, and everything has to come together just right for it to be world class. To get above that is an enormous technological challenge, whereas somebody who is at the lower end of the performance scale is actually probably relatively easy to enhance, because we have a model of all the rest of humanity, of all the average people or above average people to pattern genetic changes after. So you have a narrowing of distribution which devalues those at the upper end. And, you know, often, so that's very threatening to a class, and the people that are critiquing these technologies are generally not are those that are in positions very successful and usually rather elite in one way or another. And so it's their children who will be disadvantaged by the broad availability of these things, because, you know, people like to mouth the notion of a level playing field, but genetics and biology, there is no level playing field there, and if there were, it would be a very, very competitive environment, because a lot of the people who, we would be driven a lot by our backgrounds and our desire to have what we're seeking.
Now, my internalized leftist superego is screaming at me that one of the complaints against the whole field of genetic medicine, genetic therapy, and this vision of genetic enhancement is that a lot of the differences in people's accomplishments, a lot of the differences in people's behavior, is not determined by our genetics, but rather by psychological factors, social factors, poor schools, lack of social investment. And what do you say to the complaint that this vision and this even the whole discussion about the genetic determinants of our future, of our possibilities, ignores the need for social reforms and for social egalitarianism, which could have equal or more consequences for people's health and intelligence?
Well, we've been working on those things for a long time, and they will remain important. But I think there's a great fear of just looking at genetics. There's a certain denial about the importance of biology, I believe. And the results and the science in this, I think, is fairly clear, that for most of the kinds of things that we consider important about who we are, anything from, you know, whether we're very shy, whether we're introverted, what our height is, what our IQ is, all of these things that are important to us, if you look at the variation in the human population in a particular trait within the developed world, so we're not talking about people who are environmentally extremely challenged, about a quarter to three quarters for any trait can be explained by genetics of the variation. So this is a very, very important window into who we are. And the other sort of influences tend not to be things that we share with the rest of our family, not shared family environment, but things that are unique to each person individually, whether we got sick, whether we were screamed at, what our fetal environment was, all of these things that are very, very difficult to control. So I think that as you get into at least a more affluent developed world, most of the biggest environmental things that are going to have huge impacts, for instance, malnutrition, things of that sort, are as we deal with those, the more that we deal with those, then the more important genetics becomes.
It's funny, one of the arguments that is also mobilized against genetic technology is that we might have a lack of future diversity, of human diversity. And at the same time that they're arguing that the majority, that many of the critics are arguing that the majority of human behavior and human characteristics are not determined genetically, they're arguing that if we had common healthy genes, that we would somehow lack human diversity, which seems contrary. But let's explore that point a little bit, because I think that it reveals some of the kind of misanthropy of the Luddite arguments, that they have a lot of the critics have this notion that if we allowed parents to have choice over the genetic characteristics of their kid, that every parent in the country would go out and buy Britney Spears' genes for their daughters and the Backstreet Boys for their kids, for their boys, and that just doesn't seem to be logical to me. It seems like, you know, Chinese parents are going to want to have Chinese kids, and smart parents are going to want to have smart kids, and athletic parents want to have athletic kids.
Yeah, and in fact, it goes even beyond that. I was just speaking, there are people in the deaf community, and I was just speaking with one the other day who really believe that deafness is not a disability, it's not a handicap, it's cultural, and they make no bones about it. They would choose to have deaf children. So people's choices are not going to be what we would expect them to be superficially.
Should that be allowed?
I find it very difficult to see how you would not allow that, because if you're picking an embryo, if you're just choosing among embryos, it's one thing if you take an embryo and you somehow damage it or create a problem that would end up resulting in deafness. That's one thing. But if you take a dozen embryos and run genetic tests on them and find one that would develop into a child who is deaf, then you're going to pass a law that has to be destroyed, that no one can choose that embryo? That seems to me a very, very difficult thing to do, because then
there must be limits, though. I mean, if parents systematically make choices which diminish the capabilities of their children, if there was some sub-community that decided to do that, that would be a legitimate grounds for public intervention, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think so as well. It's going to be very difficult to figure out exactly what the boundaries of those interventions are, and it's going to be something. I mean, these are the kinds of issues that we should be discussing, not that some mad cloner somewhere, some rogue scientist is going to perhaps damage a child, when we know that if we were really worried about the damage to children, there are 1,000 things that could be done that would save far more children. From just trying to ensure basic nutrition and prenatal care and, avoiding abusive alcohol in pregnant women, these sorts of things. So, you know, this is not going to be, you know, some path to some utopia. We're going to have enormous problems, and it's going to bring huge challenges to society, and there is going to be no consensus about how to handle these issues, because some people, like Leon Cass and others, look at this as the invasion of the inhuman, that this is going to destroy, if it happens, virtually everything that we have struggled so long to build, everything that society and civilization has worked towards. And other people, many transhumanists among them, feel, you know, this is wonderful, this is the flowering of the human enterprise, that here we're going to be able to transcend biological limitations that other generations have only dreamed of. And if we are not very careful in the way we handle these things politically, it will literally tear our society apart. It'll make abortion and the debate over abortion look very tame indeed. And so we have to temper all of our choices by thinking about sort of what those consequences will be, because our lives are going to be driven by sort of the nature of this debate and how violent it is and how difficult it is in the years ahead. And it's kind of providing a context for that and a contextual way of thinking about these things that I've done in the book, Redesigning Humans.
Well, that's certainly one of the reasons I got interested in bioethics in general, is that it cuts orthogonally to the traditional left-right divisions on a lot of questions. You can find people, as you point out in your book, not all libertarians are comfortable with libertarian implications of biotechnology. And on the other hand, there are leftists who are getting in bed with far-right conservatives over these issues. So it seems to be a whole new dimension of politics emerging.
Yeah, I think that Virginia Postrel has identified this very well in her sense of sort of stasists and dynamists, the sense of people who are really afraid of open-ended change and those who are quite comfortable with it. And that's kind of what the dividing line is. But, you know, our challenge is really not how we're going to deal with cloning or genetically modified foods or any particular technology. We'll kind of muddle through with them. It's whether we really are unable to continue, we're unwilling to continue to face the possibilities of the future. And we, out of fear of the implications of these new technologies, we draw back and try and block them and basically turn over their development to other braver peoples in other regions of the world. And, you know, having traveled in China, I can assure you that there are others that would leap in and be very happy to move into any void that is left. Genetically modified foods are banned in large regions of Europe, and China has tripled its production of genetically modified crops in the last 2 years and sees this as an enormous opportunity to play a larger role in our future. And so these things are going to happen, and we need to think if we want to play a role in it or if we just want to turn it over to other people, because we're going to face these issues even if we don't change and alter and modify our genes. If we don't participate in that, we're still going to see the information. And, you know, it's very fashionable to say, well, there's only one in a thousand, only one in a thousand of the letters in our genetic code are different, so we're 99.9% the same. We're all identical. But we know that's not true because we're so fine-tuned to detect minor differences among us. I mean, we all look the same to some visitor from another planet or to a tiger looking for lunch. But to each other, there are enormous differences, and there is a biological contribution to many of them that is substantive. And we're going to have to come to grips with these differences among ourselves as individuals and with differences among different populations and subpopulations of humans. And to do that in the context of an egalitarian sort of democratic framework. And to simply deny that exists is not a very good start to doing that.
I've been speaking with Greg Stock. He's the author of Redesigning Humans, Our Inevitable Genetic Future. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, I really enjoyed it. I always enjoy our conversations.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.